Radio.
Guinness and God presents Father Dominic Murphy speaking on the topic, What Does the Church Say About IVF? Guinness and God is brought to you by the Catholic Life Archdiocesan team of the Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn and Australian Catholic University.
Thank you very much, Ruth. Well, if we could, I know that yesterday we celebrated the Feast of the Annunciation, and so I just like just a little prayer. I know we're here with our Father, but you know the response to this. The angel of the Lord declared unto Mary, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
We'll do a bit more of that later. Perhaps it's providential, but when Nick first approached me to do this talk, he said, look, you could come and do a talk stress-free, you know, just tell us your story, and that'll be great. I just want to be stress-free for you. Or you could do something else. And so I said to him about this talk that I had worked on, and in fact, my main source for this was Dr. Bridget Fout, who's superb, and she'd be totally awesome if you ever got her on this one, to talk about IVF, what the church's teaching is on this, or a little subtitle of it, if you like, Should We Make Babies Without Making Love? Probably the heart of the matter. And as Providence would have it, yesterday, babies are ace, aren't they? Don't you reckon? They're really ace, like, deeply. I was at another talk I wasn't giving, thankfully, and there was this 9-month-old little baby, very cute baby. She was on one of those daddy things, you know. So she was very happy there. And, you know, 9 months, there's something very lovely, people-friendly. You know, they haven't got shy yet, and they're just looking around. So she, you know, you do the eyebrow thing, you know. And then she started talking to me, and it was a really long story. And then it was a funny one because she laughed a lot. I'm not sure what we're talking about. But just that lovely, you know, the child and that deep parental instinct that we have all of us in. Earlier that day, a 20-month-year-old baby, his name is Raphael, his mother came to visit me. We used to work together, and we're at the ACU Square, and Raphael, he's just started walking, and he's such a boy, you know. And he's got blonde hair, blue eyes, determination. So as he's walking, you know, it's the first steps are a bit rocky, so he quite liked it that I was near to grab his hand if he needed to, but he wanted to do it himself. He's seen that before, haven't he? And he'd also got some avocado and tuna and done a really good job of face painting with that. Raphael has a terminal kidney disease, and at the moment his mother is preparing to give him one of her kidneys. Beautiful, heroic story, beautiful little boy. So babies are ice, wonderful, and a gift. So what could be possibly wrong about giving infertile couples the opportunity to have babies? Well, nothing really. We'd love them all to have as many as possible. Yeah. Not like a Pope's quota or anything, but babies, you know, and fertility. I realised that touching on this one goes to the heart for many couples who have experienced the great trauma and sorrow of infertility. And infertility isn't on a decrease really, it's on the rise, it's particularly in Australia and the Western world. And I really would hope that anyone who has known this or been touched by it, and most of you would have been one way or another, I just want to know that it's something I pray for many couples and friends that I have direct contact, and I add you to that as well in preparing this talk. Life is a gift. And not always a perfect gift the way we live it, but life is a gift. It's a very key theme, what I wanted to talk to you about. Reproductive technology okay, this is a blanket thing. There's much more involved than just IVF, okay? There are actually quite a few different ones. But today, or tonight I should say, I wanted to mainly speak on this one. And it's kind of presented to us in the popular media as one of these great success stories, because it just makes such great press, doesn't it? You see, happy mum, happy dad, happy baby, happy doctor, happy everybody. You know, the longing for a child, this child's here, the great technological thing, look what we can do, aren't we amazing? And, you know, you look at it and it's very, very attractive. And these are happy, so some of us all, you know, experience that pain of infertility, look at that and go, you beauty, isn't it wonderful? In the popular press. So with the church to come with a teaching which is very, very clear about this not being seen as a good means to bring life into the world. Can I put it that way? Not a good method. Very problematic. It's pondering of this one. When the church comes to a question like this, think of it this way. We've been at the job of looking and trying to steer people to the good for 2,000 years. In fact, if I could say to you, morality, the project of morality, acting well, is the good to be done and the evil to be avoided. So when she comes to a question like this, so deep and so profound, she brings a weight of 2,000 years and more and the grace of God in its analysing of the question and reason. So it's all that kind of. So don't underestimate its capacity to see the good and avoid the evil in its recommendation on this one. No doubt too, there's possibly some of you, or maybe not, or there may not be, but some of you who know IVF children. I've baptised a few in my life as a priest, and happily, right? Once a child's brought into being, or an embryo for that matter, we treat them with dignity and respect, and you're meant to be. And we delight in you, and you are worthy of all the love and dignity. So I just want you to know that. That's the number one, okay? It's not a... But this pondering of this method and its problems, this is what we are trying to delve into tonight. Now, in 1987, as the technology unfolded of IVF, which is originally trialled in animals. In fact, I think most of the main innovators of IVF were all vets before they became IVF in humans. So the technique was kind of somewhat experimental at that time. As it developed and became more and more widespread, the question went. So the church did respond with a letter called Donum Vitae in 1987. Means the gift of life, that's its title. It then later, in 2008, responded with, it might say, an updated Donum Vitae, one called Dignitatis Person, the dignity of the person. Don't you love it that they have those big long titles? Yeah, the trick is, I'll just so you know, they usually make a Latin copy of them, and the first two significant words in the first sentence become the title of the letter. Isn't that handy to know? We can share that at a dinner party sometime.
It's useful. It's a Latin, yes.
But there's three big questions that this really throws up for us. IVF in particular, and reproductive technologies that are anonymous with it. Number one, does severing the link between sex and procreation, is that a worry? Because that's something that's being done very, very deliberately in IVF, severing the link between love making and making life. Does it strengthen our appreciation of the value of human life? And thirdly, does it make us value marriage, family, and children more or less? These are questions that I put to you to ponder. So, marriage. Wonderful marriage. I'm a veteran of 250 weddings. It's a fair bit of marriage prank, let me tell you. And a lot of dresses, too. That's the very thing I've got. I think I've got a fairly good taste for dresses. Someone, one bride wanted me to go wedding dress shopping with her, and I didn't do that. But anyway, I digress. Have any of you seen The Princess Bride?
Yes.
If you haven't, you should have. Yeah. So I've always longed to say that speech, you know. Marriage is what brings us love, true love, that dream within a dream. This is Peter Cook, it's terrible. The beauty of marriage in all of its richness. And you know, we've a great teaching of it, a beautiful and rich teaching. Not only is it just this union of two people, but we see it as a profoundly, something that God moves in and a giving of grace that couple one to the other. In fact, it's the only form of love in a human context that has these four characteristics. That it's full, total, faithful, and fruitful. In no other form of human loving, and there are many, friendship, sibling, parental, ice cream, many forms of human loving, pets. But this one, full, total, faithful, and fruitful. This is unique. And we've all come from that, ultimately. The union of man and woman, usually in marriage. Usually. And in God's astonishing providence, or the pattern that is given to us and has been with us since the beginning, is very explicit, if you like. In God's wonderful mathematics, two become one, become three. Or in my case, nine. Because we're one or six and seven. So the two becoming one become three. But I have been quite deeply influenced in my understanding of this. I was given an articulation in the theology of the body of John Paul II. So I commend that to you, those of you who might have the opportunity to study that. John Paul gave a most beautiful understanding of this communion of husband and wife, the beautifulness of it, the fullness of it. And this very important phrase he'd say is the communion of persons. And how that relationship, and that's from where we spring. We look to our origin. That's where we've come from. And also, where a child fits in to that. For we take marriage to be a vocation, the way by which most people get to heaven. It must be a most serious thing. Right? We hold that it's, you know, sacred and forever. But also that it's open to love, and that if it's a perfection of love, it's meant to make us more unselfish. This loving of husband and wife, this communion. Into children, and it's like custom made, even church speaks of the good of children in a marriage. How you have this little one that's both part of you and yet something more than you, something separate from you. And will ask of you, and parents will tell you the world over, more than you knew you had in you. They will draw from you a capacity to love that you didn't know you had. But it's a favourite story of my brother, Adrian, that's number seven in the family. He's a plumber, and yeah, he's quite a good bloke, as he's been. But they were longing for a child, and finally Sarah was born on my birthday. She does remind me of that. And he said to me, "Dom, I'm holding you, and I feel waves of love. I didn't know I had it in me, waves of love." The kind of how that little girl has, in a sense, perfected him, drawn him beyond into her capacity. He says, "You know, she laughs, and I'm just so happy. It's the joy of a parent, how it affects the joy of children and what they do to us and affect us. This is a great and profound good, and we reverence it, which you know. with the harshness of infertility into that. Surely if this is such a good, anything that can achieve that, wouldn't that be a positive? Well, as I said, there is a problem. But I tell you, when a child looks to their origin, they look to the loving union that brought them into being. It's a fairly straightforward matrix of relationships, if you like. One that has, from the beginning, flowed down to now. Life is a gift, and parents receive them as a gift. They don't actually can say what they're going to be like. They just come. And the attitude has always been that it is a gift that you receive, a life entrusted to you, your responsibility. Fulfillment in that vocation to love. Okay. Into the option, and right now I think infertility, as I mentioned, is on the rise in Australia and the West generally. I don't know if this is helpful, but human beings aren't as fertile as other creatures, generally speaking. I don't know if this will work, but if you'd ever look under a microscope at other primates and their sperm, right, under the microscope, this is what they look like. But apparently human sperm under microscope is not quite as vigorous, apparently. Otherwise it is. So it's on the rise. A couple of reasons are given for that. Number one, people's marrying later, probably entering to, you know, starting their child rearing later, so that's already. Various STDs, many people are sexually active before they get married and possibly have picked up an STD and been rendered infertile by scouring the fallopian tubes, for instance, something like chlamydia. And I did used to be a nurse, have you had mommy? Another one, it's strange, but the tension of busyness of life and even something that will come up in fertility clinics is couples actually not making love very often because they're just too busy or too tired or too tense. That's extraordinary. You know, busy, well, yet this is on the rise. Do any of you remember the cartoon George Jetson? Yeah, do you remember the picture was George would work 3 days a week and all he did was push one button? Oh boy, I haven't got to that. Or the paperless office, oh yeah, that's going to work. So here comes this technology. Now, is the church per se against any tampering, so spoken, any kind of corrective behaviour? In the way, is it all just got to be, no, don't? Not at all. In fact, in fertility, there are many things the church says, yes, this is a good use of technology. This restores the fertility and helps make, you know, the fulfillment of children possible. Even, you might be aware of a thing called natural family planning. Now, often, that has been seen as a way of prudently spacing children, you know? However, what it gets used for in an increasing number of couples is to conceive. By so, you know, working out your fertility so as to maximise the chance of conceiving. Very natural, non-invasive, perfectly valid and moral. There's others that seek to give fertility a boost, one like the Crichton method or NAPRO technology. These are other technologies that are, you know, good uses to restore, even in the case of perhaps a blockage in a fallopian tube, some sort of surgery to correct that. All good uses. So what? How is IVF then different? Why would the church say this is not a good method to bring children into the world? Well, it represents, you're probably familiar a little bit with the method. You need to obtain a number of ovums to start with. So first thing, the couple may be a problem, etc. The wife, and usually the woman's body bears the most burden of the treatments, she will take something called superovulant, which will lead her, you know, normally a woman would have an ovum once a month, roughly, right? Probably alternate ovaries in that, right? So they give a superovulant, really strong drug, right? That kind of, they might harvest 10 to 20 eggs. So her ovary looks a different shape to normal, I'd say. They harvest those eggs. Then they will get the sperm from the from the husband. Usually that's obtained via masturbation. And they might then treat that sperm. They'll test it for motility. His sperm might be very poor quality. You know, I was talking about that one, even more lacking a sense of direction. It might be found to be no good at all. But they wash it with a solution. Then there's a combining of the two gametes, the ovum and the sperm, usually a petri dish or something equivalent to that. They would fertilise quite a number. Then they would make a selection. They wait till a certain point. The cells, the first cell, two cells, four cells. At a certain point where they begin to turn to embryo stage, they can do some tests on the cells, remove a few cells, test them for genetic defects, gender, etc. The couple would then say, give a preference to what they would like in their child, and a number will normally be implanted after preparation of the womb hormonally. Then often a few won't make it that get implanted, there might be just one that takes. Now they'll do that a couple of times. Perhaps the last time I looked, it was about three times. I'll go through the whole process. But after that, they stop putting through. Quite expensive. Now, roughly, this is stats from 2007, so I'm sorry it's not quite up to date. But the success rate of embryo fertilised to live birth is about 3.5%. So if we were generous, we could say from all the embryos generated to the ones that are born, say, I'll be more favourable, say 1 in 20, we'll make it. It also presents the couple with quite a number of conundrums, which are not always very well elaborated to them at the time. They will always fertilise more embryos than they need, or could probably possibly have physically. So then they have a number in the fridge, frozen, and so what to do with it? That then becomes, they have these little ones, very small little ones in the fridge, what to do for an indeterminate period. There might be requests of other couples for an embryo, or there might be requests for embryos for experiment to improve the procedure. Right? Sounds like a noble cause, but that sort of pressure, that kind of conundrum couple can be presented with. But what we hold for very, and it's in our Catholic understanding of the human person, a sacredness of human life from the beginning to the end, right? Natural conception, from conception to natural death. You've probably heard that phrase before. Because we believe that the human person is not an animal like other animals. In fact, every single human being has a unique creative moment in God's creative generosity. That every human being has an intrinsic dignity. That means you can't be replaced by anyone. There'll only ever be one of you. You are willed directly by God into existence. Now, we might have the technology to conceive human embryos outside of the womb, such as this does. But we would see and understand that there is some participation of God in their creation. They have a human dignity that's intrinsic. When the soul enters them, the way we play it, although we can't really test that, is we take it right from the beginning. We play it absolutely safe with human beings, even microscopic human beings. So the teaching from this, when you have, firstly, making a lot of embryos, bringing a lot of human beings into being. Is that okay? You got that? Beings into being? Yeah. Mr. Bean? No, I'm excellent now. Okay, a little, like my water. This one said, I've noted this is water. Okay. That itself is very problematical. But also, there's a very deep, what we call this personalistic norm coming over to you. That we should never use a human being as a means to an end. Have you ever heard that? And sometimes, I think intuitively, we know that to be very true. How many of us in our own language would say, she used me. He used me. We know that we shouldn't, there's a kind of a, ah. And that goes right across the board. We can see through the most vulnerable, either end of life. We should never use another human being as a means to an end. Caught within this method is a kind of necessary use of others to achieve, so that, you know, 1-to-20 ratio is a kind of a cost that which we find unacceptable. That's you know, too much violence to life there. Secondly, the possibility for, you're probably aware of the relationship matrix that it generates, which seems to, in a certain sense, undermine the relationship of the marriage. Okay. Which we see this is intrinsic in the method almost, unavoidable. For instance, say the best case scenario, you've got good sperm from the husband and good ovum, okay, you combine them in the petri dish. Then you've got a technician, okay, who actually oversees that. And then you have the surgeon who then implants the child. There's a kind of already a mixing. That's probably the simplest one, and yet still complicated. Then you have perhaps what does happen now, donor sperm, donor ovum, donor womb, like surrogacy for various reasons. Then you might have even what has happened in some cases, someone who's passed away, who's not even alive, and the possibility of using them. So this, the complication of the matrix of relationships, can you see how complicated it begins to get? Like it's heading down, no less, a slippery slope. It's something what we're living with. So does the, you know, that second question I put to you, does it strengthen our appreciation for human life? Let's say, if you're looking at the method, the way it uses embryos and sees them, built into it is using them as a means to an end. There is, in fact, in the attempt to achieve that one life birth, there's a devaluing. They're saying, well, it's all right, it means to have some collateral damage. Nice word, softening word, but actually it comes at a great cost, the loss of quite a few on the way to achieving that. It has in it, within it, a pattern, a way of thinking, well, it's okay to, and the argument's made, well, to improve the method, therefore we need more to experiment on. So then it's okay, we'd say, a microscopic human being, that's all that we'd see as having dignity, then being used experimentally, something that, once again, an affront to human dignity for all of us. For you know that all of us were a one cell zygote. You know the name zygote? It's the first, the very top, when the ovum meets sperm, the two sets of genes combined to make 46, 23 of them each. You're completely there, genetically. Completely there. The only thing that is added, no more genetic stuff, is time, nutrition, and food. That's it. The continuum of life is that. That's all of it. So I understand, like I said, we must be protective of human life right from its beginning to its end. So it seems it and the kind of experimentation that was thought unthinkable slowly becomes more and more appropriate because you've started down this attitude built into it. Does it make us value family and marriage? Well, also within it, this commodification of children. Whereas once seeing it in the more natural, the child is a gift that comes to you, and maybe that child's got disabilities, maybe they've got genetic problems, you know, personality problem, who knows, we get those later, don't we, usually? But you receive the child as a gift. Now, when you are given the option to, in a sense, search and destroy, right, go through, get them checked out, and as we become more refined in our testing methods, like the human genome, So I see the film Gattaca.
Mm-hmm.
Gattaca. Here where you end up with a discrimination based on your genetic profile. So certain jobs you can't get because of your genetic profile. But that's not too far away. I don't mean to scare tactics, but I just think that kind of, you know, once again, people being divided into, for instance, to my knowledge, there has not been a Down syndrome IVF child born. They screen the embryos for genetic problems. Because it wouldn't be PR for the method, so necessarily there's a kind of refining at that level. But what about, as seems to, you know, the commodification? And okay, I want a child like this. I want them this tall, this kind of IQ, etc. So, and if I need to use a donor to get that and achieve that, so on the unfolding of it. That's something that we're seeing already. Also, some more bizarre things that have started to happen. There was, I think 2008, a lady in England, she's 62, so it's menopause. Her husband, who was 60, really wanted to have a child. So she then got a donor egg at his sperm and then had herself with the IVF, and they gave birth to a baby at 62. You're beyond, in kind of the way, the natural way, you'd be at a certain age to look after a child, which is sort of, you know, because he wanted to have a child. There is a mother in Texas whose son was killed in a car accident back in 2007. And she was grieving very badly, so she had some of his sperm put in the fridge, and she hoped to have a child made from that so that she could somehow feel like he was still with her. There's another case where one of the children, already born, has a lethal blood disorder. So they IVF selected a twin or a very genetically close sibling that they could then utilise some of the blood from that child to help with the transfusion, you know, what they call save your siblings. This kind of commodification that it's already, this mentality that it's already with us. And for children of IVF too, it's been going for quite a while now, and there's a girl born of donor, a donor egg and a donor sperm in England who, there was like a favourite, they used to call it the wank bank, apparently in England. And there were four very popular donors because they were tall and intelligent, one was a med student. That was kept from them, who their donor were. Now, going through the records, she was able to discover she actually has more than 200 half-siblings in the world. And she really wants to meet them because that natural human thing, where did I begin? Who do I come from? Who am I related to? Very naturally set in all of us, you know, part of that natural wandering. It's a terribly messy thing, and why shouldn't she? And maybe she might meet one of her half-brothers and accidentally marry them. You know, it might produce some problems when you marry when you're so related. Just how complicated and what a can of worms this is. So, let me see, I've got down, I'm pretty well near to where I want to get with this one. There is more to say. There is more to look at. But I hope that I've been able to take some of the wisdom that's said and put to us this way is fraught with real trouble for how children are brought into the world, how the treatment of human life. And a direct attack on human dignity. Therefore, this method of bringing life to the world we see as a bad one and shouldn't be followed.
That was Father Dominic Murphy with What Does the Church Say About IVF? Guinness and God is presented once a month at King O'Malley's Pub in Canberra. And for more shows, interviews and talks, visit cradio.org.au.